This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose, and I'm continuing to read from the book Gathering Moss by Robin Wall Kimmerer. It's a charming book, and I'm hoping to tempt you to read some of the chapters I won't have time to read to you. So I'm reading the first three chapters and the last chapter, and hope I will have enticed you enough that you'll look for the book and read what's in the middle. This chapter is called Learning to See. After 4 hours at 3,200 feet, I finally succumbed to the stupor of a transcontinental flight. Between takeoff and landing, we are each in suspended animation, a pause between chapters of our lives. When we stare out the window, the sun's glare, the landscape is only a flat projection with mountain ranges reduced to wrinkles in the continental skin. Oblivious to our passage overhead, other stories are unfolding beneath us. Blackberries ripen in the August sun. A woman packs a suitcase and hesitates at her doorway. A letter is opened, and the most surprising photograph slides from between the pages. But we are moving too fast, and we are too far away. All the stories escape us except our own. When we turn away from the window, the stories recede into two-dimensional map of green and brown below, like a trout disappearing into the shadow of an overhanging bank, leaving you staring at the flat surface of the water, wondering if you saw it at all. I put my newly acquired and still frustrating reading glasses on and lament my middle-aged vision. The words on the page float in and out of focus. How is it possible that I can no longer see what was once so plain? My fruitless strain to see what I know is right in front of me reminds me of my first trip into the Amazon rainforest. Our indigenous guides would patiently point out the iguana resting on a branch or a toucan looking down at us from the leaves. What was so obvious to their practiced eye was nearly invisible to us. Without practice, we simply couldn't interpret the pattern of light and shadow as iguana, and so it remained right before our eyes, frustratingly unseen. We poor, myopic humans, with neither the raptor's gift of long-distance acuity nor the talents of a housefly for panoramic vision. However, with our big brains, we at least are aware of the limits of our vision. With a degree of humility rare in our species, we acknowledge there is much we can't see, and so contrive remarkable ways to observe the world. Infrared satellite imagery, optical telescopes, and the Hubble Space Telescope bring vastness within our visual sphere. But at the middle scale, that of the unaided eye, our senses seem to be strangely dulled. With sophisticated technology, we strive to see what is beyond us, but we are often blind to what we're seeing when we've only scratched the surface. Our acuity in this middle scale seems diminished, not by any failing of the eyes, but by the willingness of the mind. Has the power of our devices led us to distrust our unaided eyes? Or have we become dismissive of what takes no technology but only time and patience to perceive? Attentiveness alone can rival the most powerful magnifying lens. I remember my first encounter with the North Pacific at Rialto Beach on the Olympic Peninsula. As a landlocked botanist, I was anticipating my first glimpse of the ocean, craning my neck around every bend in the winding dirt road. We arrived in a dense fog that clung to the trees and beaded my hair with moisture. Had the skies been clear, we would have seen only what we expected: rocky coast, lush forest, and the broad expanse of sea. That day, the air was opaque and the backdrop of the coastal hills visible only when spires of Sitka spruce briefly emerged from the clouds. We knew the ocean's presence only by the deep roar of the surf out beyond the tide pools. Strange, at this edge of immensity, the world had become very small, the fog obscuring all but the middle distance. All my pent-up desire to see the panorama of the coast became focused only on the things I could see, the beach and the surrounding tide pools. Wandering in the grayness, we lost sight of each other, my friends disappearing like ghosts in just a few steps. Our muffled voices knit us together, calling out the discovery of a perfect pebble or the intact shell of a razor clam. I knew from poring over field guides in anticipation of the trip that we should see starfish in the tide pools, and this would be my first. The only starfish I'd ever seen was a dried one in a zoology class, and I was eager to see them at home where they belonged. As I looked among the mussels and limpets, I saw none. The tide pools were encrusted with barnacles and exotic-looking algae, anemones, and chitons, enough to satisfy curiosity of a novice tide pooler, but no starfish. Picking my way over rocks, I pocketed fragments of mussel shells the color of the moon and tiny sculpted pieces of driftwood, looking continuously. No starfish. Disappointed, I straightened up from the pools to relieve a growing stiffness in my back. And suddenly, I saw one, bright orange, clinging to a rock right before my eyes. And then it was as if a curtain had been pulled away, and I saw them everywhere like stars, revealing themselves one by one in a darkening summer night. Orange stars in the crevices of black rock, speckled burgundy stars with outreached arms, purple stars nestled together like a family huddled against the cold. In a cascade of discovery, the invisible was suddenly made visible. A Cheyenne elder of my acquaintance once told me the best way to find something is to not go looking for it. This is a hard concept for a scientist, but he said to watch out of the corner of your eye, open to possibility, and what you seek will be revealed. The revelation of suddenly seeing what I was blind to only moments before is a sublime experience for me. The boundaries between my world and the world of another being getting pushed back with sudden clarity, an experience both humbling and joyful. The sensation of sudden visual awareness is produced in part by the formation of a search image in the brain. In a complex visual landscape, the brain initially registers all the incoming data without critical evaluation. Five orange arms in a star-like pattern. Smooth black rock, light and shadow. All this is input, but then the brain does not immediately interpret the data and convey their meaning to the conscious mind. Not until the pattern is repeated with feedback from the conscious mind do we know that what we are seeing. It is in this way that animals become skilled detectors of their prey by differentiating complex visual patterns into particular configuration that means food. For example, some warblers are very successful predators when a certain caterpillar is at epidemic numbers, sufficiently abundant to produce a search image in the bird's brain. However, the very same insects may go undetected when their numbers are low. The neural pathways have to be trained by experience to process what is being seen. The synapses fire and the stars come out. The unseen is suddenly plain. My former husband used to teasingly deride my passion for mosses, saying that mosses were just decoration. To him, mosses were merely the wallpaper of the forest, providing ambience for his photographs of trees. A carpet moss does, in fact, provide a lustrous green blur of the background, resolves itself into focus, an entirely new dimension appears. That wallpaper, which seemed at first glance to be of uniform weave, is in fact a complex tapestry, a brocaded surface of intricate pattern. The moss is many different mosses of widely divergent forms. There are fronds like miniature ostrich plumes, shining tufts like the silky hair of a baby. A close encounter with a mossy log always makes me think of entering a fantasy fabric shop. Its windows overflow with rich textures and colors that invite your fingertips over a silky drape. The yardage of nubbly brown tweed is shot through with gilt threads of campylium. To pass hurriedly without looking is like walking by the Mona Lisa, chatting on a cell phone, oblivious. I find the language of microscopic description compelling in its clarity. The edge of a leaf is not simply uneven. There is a glossary of specific words for a leaf margin. Dentate for large, coarse teeth. Serrate for saw blade edge. Serrulate if the teeth are fine and even. Ciliate for a fringe along the edge. A leaf folded by accordion pleats is complanate when flattened as if squashed between two pages of a book. Every nuance of moss architecture has a word. The students exchange these words like the secret language of a fraternity, and I watch the bond between them grow. Having the words also creates an intimacy with the plant that speaks of careful observation. Even the surfaces of individual cells have their own descriptors. While they may initially seem like arcane technical terms, these words have life to them. What better word for a thick, round shoot swelling with water than Juliaceous? Mosses are so little known by the general public that only a few have been given common names. Most are known solely by their scientific Latin names, a fact which discourages most people from attempting to identify them. But I like scientific names because they are beautiful and intricate as the plants they name. Indulge yourself in words, rhythmic and musical. Looking at mosses adds a depth of intimacy to knowing a forest, walking in the woods and discerning the presence of species from 50 paces away just by its color connects me strongly to the place. That certain green, the way it catches the light, gives away its identity, like recognizing the walk of a friend before you see their face. Just as you can pick out the voice of a loved one in the tumult of a noisy room, or spot your child's smile in a sea of faces, intimate connection allows recognition in an all-too-anonymous world. This sense of connection arises from a special kind of discrimination, a search image that comes from a long time spent looking and listening. Intimacy gives us a different way of seeing when visual acuity is not enough. This is Helen Cannon. Thank you for listening.